This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. It's the anniversary of the Battle in Seattle, WTO, the Battle in Seattle, N30. So Scott Fife arranged for Shannon Wilson to talk with us about what happened on N30, on the anniversary of N30. So to save time, I didn't do bios, so the first one to talk is Scott and then Shannon Wilson, both local activists here in Eugene. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
Why is the World Trade Organization important, and what is it that they do, and why should we be especially be hearing about this now? It seems to have gotten out of the news.
Well, one thing they've done, they regulated all the health and safety regulations, environmental regulations, labor laws, and they basically gave it to a three-person panel in Geneva, Switzerland. And, basically it took away the rights of states, municipalities, and even nations to govern those laws that I just mentioned.
Well, yeah, and I was in Eugene around 95, 96, and doing forest defense stuff. And about 1999, the summer of, I just heard about the WTO and what it represented. And I was like, oh, wow, this is huge, and they're coming to Seattle. So I started organizing in the summer of 1999, created a banner and started doing street bannering, just saying, you know, the World Trade Organization, going to basically outlaw, you know, environmental regulations and labor laws for corporate profit. And from there, Eugene and the U of O, some folks from the U of O, started organizing to go to Seattle and to go down and shut down the World Trade Organization meetings in Seattle in November 1999.
Well, because what the World Trade Organization allows corporations to sue either countries or even America, but other countries, for stopping them from extracting resources from those countries at slave wage rates.
And destroying the environment.
And destroying the environment if these countries try to stop them with legal means, these corporations can go to the World Trade Organization and usurp those efforts.
Yeah, and you have to pay a fine if you get ruled against at the WTO. But it's really anti-democratic.
And this goes back to, we're all talking about neoliberalism now, but this goes back to the Trilateral Commission. This is something that was done by both Republicans and Democrats, right?
Yeah. It was basically like, you know, NAFTA came before that in 94, and it was, you know, George Bush Sr., he couldn't get it through, but when Clinton got in there, he sailed it through, and then we were stuck with, and that was between three countries, Mexico, United States, and Canada, and then they just kind of expanded the whole thing. It was basically corporations uber alles is what I would call it.
I mean, can you give me some examples of what the World Trade Organization and the IMF... The IMF goes down and, like Argentina to this day, owes money to multinational corporations and vulture capitalists because of IMF and World Trade Organization policies.
Well, it's just basically the ruling elite are basically controlling, you know, what people can do, you know, how they can regulate and protect their environment. They're trying to just throw it all out. So, it's profits first. You have something we want, and we're going to take it, and you can't tell us no because we're going to take out your environmental laws or your labor laws. And the WTO was that tool to do that, mostly ruled by, you know, European Union and the United States, or the major beneficiaries. But then they allowed China to join, and so it's just a you know, and that's why we were there to say, no, we're not going to allow this, the super elite, these fascists to take over our world and destroy our world before our very eyes. And we're going to shut you down.
and create a kangaroo court to facilitate that process is basically what this is. And I just want to point out, too, that you mentioned the elite, and this is the argument that the conservatives have, is that, that just voted in Donald Trump, is that the elite are taking over the world. We've been saying this for 50 years, that the elite are taking over the world. And but the solution is not, their solution is Reaganomics. A return to Reaganomics, which is what got us into this in the first place.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I've been resisting since Ronald Reagan, you know, this corporate, fascism taking over our lives and our planet. And, you know, we had 4 years during Jimmy Carter to kind of placate people and relax people, thinking that, oh, you know, things are going to get better now and you know, the people are going to be in control of their governments. But that was all thrown out the window in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was appointed or elected, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, so it's been a downhill slide for 40-some years. And now we've got full-blown fascism. And when we took on the WTO, that was like the pinnacle of saying, no, we don't accept this corporate rule, this fascism taking over our planet and destroying our planet for profit of a few.
Yeah, you know, like privatizing seeds. You know, like there's this tree in India that's called the neem tree, and they have all these uses. And all of a sudden, the corporation said, oh, we own this neem tree. And they're like, what? We've been using this for thousands of years. And, you know, they wanted to get all the different seeds. And so you were basically stuck, Monsanto, with, you know, the lowest price for the, you had to buy the seeds from them, basically is what it was. And they were only, one of them was like this suicide seed where they wouldn't produce the next generation.
When Reagan famously threatened to put the air traffic controllers in jail for going on strike, so he was anti-union, and so this is it's basically socialism for multinational corporations. It's state-sponsored corporatism, which was Mussolini's definition of fascism. Is why we're using the F word here, is because it is literally fascism to sponsor for the government to work for corporations.
Well, it was socialize the cost and privatize the profits. I mean, that's what we've got right now with, you know, MUPTI and different things locally and state-wise. And, you know,
whether you believe in capitalism or not, corporations all have their own associations. They have their own unions. They have the Manufacturers Association, especially the Restaurant Owners Association, the Real Estate Association, and the Chemical Association and the Automotive Association, the Grocery Owners Associations, they all have their own associations where they set prices and make backroom agreements. There is no, these aren't capitalism. And so this is what, and so now they were doing this to the third world, and, you know, like Cuba was a, these banana republics, they were exploiting Cuba for its banana crop and Central America for this banana crop. And now what you're seeing now is they've moved these policies. They're using them against us here in the United States. And this is, again, why this is so important to understand, is because this is what, now they're using this against the United States. Is that correct? These policies for corporations?
You know, I can't say I'm an expert on all these different agreements and the laws. It's just overwhelming to keep track, and that's deliberate. They want people confused because that's how they can covertly do whatever they want behind closed doors and make deals with governments. And basically, they've taken over our government. They've taken over pretty much every government in the world. It's the oligarchs, the elite, and they want it all, and we're just their cattle. We're just their slaves to serve them. And that's how they see the people of the world. And the people need to stand up and say, no, that's not acceptable. We're not going to be your slaves. We're not going to watch you destroy our world before our eyes or our children's future. And so that's what we have to do again. It's you know, and I don't know, you know, I hope people will step up and there won't be this massive oppression of people, but it appears that's the direction it's going. But we've got this planet to save, and they were going to destroy it and human life with it if we don't stop them.
All right, so you guys went to Seattle. So what happened? There was a bunch of organizing that went on knowing this WTO was happening. Can you tell me about that?
Well, for me, I didn't hardly know anything about it. I'd been organizing against the Gulf War, and a bunch of people went to San Francisco, and I didn't go, and then I was kind of kicking myself. And so they said, oh, there's this WTO thing happening in Seattle. And I thought, well, I had missed out on the bigger demonstrations. I'd like to go that. I was based in Salt Lake City. But what I found a lot when I got there, you know, the first night they had a jubilee where they had a big march in the rain trying to forgive all this debt around the world, because a lot of times it will be like a dictator that will, you know, they'll give them money to the World Bank or the IMF, and then the guy will pocket it. And basically these countries are left with a big, you know, debt that they owe that nobody really benefited from. And so when I got there, I learned a lot. And then that night they also had a Michael Moore and Michael Franti and a bunch of people spoke at a convention center and started talking about this stuff. And then I really started to learn what the WTO was.
Well, yeah, when I learned about the WTO, we were doing forest defense work here, and we had a couple of tree sits going up Fall Creek and Winbury. And so we tried to get the town aware of this, you know, Eugene community aware of it. And we were having meetings pretty much every week for a couple of months leading up to the WTO, which is which was November 30th. And we formed affinity groups, and our goal was to basically shut down the WTO, shut down a street or an intersection by locking down or whatever with our bodies in a nonviolent way, of course. And yeah, so a lot of folks from Eugene went up there to do that.
It was really preventing the delegates from going in and taking, you know, to stop them from the whole thing taking place. And that's why, you know, people tried to create a perimeter around where the meetings were supposed to take place. And you know, a lot of it was just, you know, it was successful. They weren't able to go in and start, but then there was also a police crackdown.
Yeah. I mean, just if you want a timeline, we showed up there the night before. There was a big consensus meeting, and I think it was facilitated by Starhawk. And there was probably 100 to 200 people in this room, and they represented all the people that were going to block a certain intersection around the ministerial meetings. So we all kind of got assigned different intersections and different points, pinch points, where we could block delegates or buses or whatever from getting into the ministerial meeting. And to me, it didn't look like we had enough numbers. I mean, I was thinking, well, we need a lot more people than just like this 200 or 300 people that we see. But so we were thinking, well, we're going to do the best we can. So the next day, we had this like a parade where all these folks put together these paper mache things, and part of that parade though was hidden within these floats or whatever they created were actually lockdown devices, where they the Eugene actually created this stage or platform that they disguised as something else and as like a float or something, and walked it right into the intersection, And then basically it was a metal steel reinforced stage that they put together, and about 15 to 20 people locked down to that stage with U-locks around their necks to the stage. And so that was the Eugene affinity group, and a lot of those folks were from U of O and just the community here in Eugene. And that was the beginning of blocking that one intersection. I think it was Pine Street, but I'd have to look at the pictures again. And then all the other affinity groups were blocking their own intersections almost at the same time.
And so this was one of the first times that this type of stuff was used, right? They had been using it at tree sits and things like that, but where do you think these ideas came from?
Well, you know, we were, you know, kind of center here was forest defense work and Cascadia forest defenders, and we had been blocking, you know, roads, logging roads, putting up tree sits, locking down to heavy equipment or logging equipment, things like that. So we brought our kind of expertise to the other folks who weren't familiar with those kind of tactics, and then we incorporated them during that blockade. But you know, we started the blocking those intersections, and there was a good number of people. There was probably several hundred people kind of protecting the people who were locked down as like a buffer around them. And maybe within an hour or so or thereof, the police started getting really aggressive, and they started shooting tear gas and percussion grenades
at the buffer people.
At the people who were people who were actually blocking certain, like the ministerial meeting room itself or the building itself.
The first line of defense,
right?
To the
lockdown. Right, they're trying to push out these frontline people who are protecting the blockaders who are locked down. And then subsequent to that, then we started hearing that, oh well, there's some black bloc breaking windows or trashing corporate storefronts somewhere else, you know, a few blocks away or something from where we were. We didn't see any of that in front of us, but we started hearing about it. And things actually started calming down. Like the cops stopped using tear gas and rubber bullets and whatever it means, and batons. And at that point, it came apparent that, like, they pulled back from attacking the peaceful protesters at that point.
This is the 30th you're describing.
The 30th was the day that we actually blocked the ministerial from happening, because the delegates could not get in. Some of them tried. I was in the front line at one point, a couple hundred of us blocking two streets. And we were all sitting down. Most of us were sitting down with our backs towards, you know, these probably 50 cops or more that were like lined up along the street, kind of like, I don't know what they were doing, kind of blockading us from moving forward or going into a certain zone. And they, you know, they had all their riot gear and these like 3 foot long baton sticks. I don't know what you call them.
Yeah, they had batons that they designed especially for the WTO.
Yeah, not just a nightstick. These are large. You can see these in the videos.
Yeah, so one delegate actually started punching his way, trying to get through us, like punching people and fighting with people, literally. And he actually got through just above us or right next to us. And these cops were like huge. I mean, some of them are like 250 to 300 pounds, or like linebackers or ex-football players, right? Plus they have all this riot gear on. And he got through, and I don't know what happened or what they perceived him, but they actually pummeled him with two of the cops like pushed him back, right? Not just pushed him back, shoved him back. He went off his feet and landed about 5 feet over the top of us, shoulder and head first onto the asphalt.
And this is a delegate.
Yeah, this was a delegate. I don't know if they were confused or they were just pissed off at this delegate because, you know, he represented whatever. But so then at that point, the crowd saw this. There's like hundreds of people that are not at the front line saw this. And it was like hundreds of people rushed at us thinking like, oh, this cop just like totally, you know, brutalized this guy. And it looked like it was going to become a riot. Because they were just rushing at us, right, to defend this person that they thought was just a protester. And so a good number of us just stayed seated and started screaming, you know, nonviolence, sit down, sit down, sit down. And eventually the crowd, you know, stopped and didn't rush the cops because, you know, it's like they were just sort of like, the cops are right there and we're underneath them, you know, and we could have been crushed or who knows what. But yeah, so that was the most violent part of it that I had seen other than the police shooting people with rubber bullets and, you know, tear gas and pepper spray, of course. If you saw the video on RIP WTO.
Well, and so this is the problem with overreaction by the police is that they can't even control their own people. Even the delegates would end up being damaged or injured.
Well, they ended up having a lot of lawsuits after that. And some of the tear gas, I knew people, they told me they couldn't really get that out of their lungs for months afterwards. And, you know, also the cops were using horses and a lot of people were... animal rights supporters, and it was just so people didn't want to, you know, affect the horses, but it's pretty wild when you've got an animal that's, you know, quite a few hundred pounds on top of you, and I don't know.
Yeah, and my experience was they pushed, they corralled a bunch of people into a causeway that was between two buildings, and I had to jump out of the way I would have been crushed, stampeded. And luckily, I found refuge inside that causeway. So they're just to push people, just to move people around. The cops were moving people around just so haphazardly that lucky I didn't get killed.
At some point in the day, they just decided to call off the ministerial, and you know that's when we were walking around, and a lot of the buildings were boarded up. I remember there was a. Like one of the local television stations had a van down there and they were all locked inside and everybody had tagged the television truck. It was pretty funny. But basically, you know, like there were small shops and nobody, you know, messed with them. They realized that it was the corporations. In some ways, it was just like a backlash against, you know, our corporate dictatorship. I don't know what else to call it. And so when people started going wild and breaking windows, they weren't hitting the mob paw stops. They were, you know, taking down the letters off Nike.
Right. Building. Because both Nike and Starbucks, Nike was using slave labor in their sweatshops at that point. It had been well publicized. And Starbucks was exploiting coffee workers in the third world. So that's why those were targeted. And I just want to point out, too, I walked away. I left because of the tear gas. I started getting heart palpitations from the tear gas. So I walked away, and it was only a small few block area. It was just around the WTO meeting place. The rest of the town there was birds chirping, and the rest of the, it was actually a beautiful day in November in Seattle, the rest of the town. So it wasn't like we were shutting down the entire city of Seattle. It was just a small area where the WTO was meeting. Was that discussed, though? Was violence and vandalism discussed at that initial meeting that you went to, Shannon?
Well, yeah, the night before the 29th, when they're having this, you know, basically a strategy session and tactic discussion, they didn't really discuss that I can recall. But yeah, they did say this was nonviolent and, you know, it's going to be a relatively safe event. I mean, no event is 100% guaranteed to be safe, especially if you're blocking, you know, physically blocking something from happening or something from being destroyed. There's always the likelihood that the police are going to overreact and beat people up to remove them or pepper spray them. And I've seen it again and again since, you know, 1995, the Warner Creek campaign and the jail riot here in Lane County, the June 1st tree occupation on Broadway and downtown Eugene, where they almost killed people just for sitting in a tree. So you know, that was always there in people's mind, and they were reminded of that at this meeting. But yeah, and then the following day, of course, you know, the cops did start brutalizing people, and, you know, people probably were seriously injured. Those rubber bullets, you know, if they hit somebody in the eye, that's it. Your eye's gone. You know, and a lot of us were wearing protective gear, but a lot of us were not. You know, the regular folks from Seattle, and I mean, there was all sorts of ages there. A lot of high school age people were there blocking the streets with us. And so it was like a community that stepped up to resist this.
But no one had planned to do vandalism on Starbucks and Nike at that initial meeting. Nobody stood up and said, hey, we're going to do violence. And, you know, because the Eugene anarchists were blamed for the violence.
Well,
all that is ridiculous.
Well,
as a group, they were not
somewhat ridiculous and not. I mean, there was a contingent from Eugene that were more radical, maybe called themselves anarchists or Black Bloc or whatever, you know, Earth Firsters. And some of those folks probably did participate in the Black Bloc actions. But I want to clarify, though, those actions only started to happen after the police brutalized people with pepper spray, rubber bullets, and tear gas. You know, you've seen it in the video. And they were not going to stop until all those folks were removed by using those tactics. And so the Black Bloc's response was, okay, you're going to do that to us. We're going to go downtown, the other part of downtown, and destroy corporate businesses, break windows. You know, and, you know, it's not going to destroy a business because you break a window. Windows are replaceable. When you permanently injure somebody for their life with these, you know, chemicals or projectiles, That's a lot more violent than breaking a window.
Well, I'll tell you, when I got back to Salt Lake, I was on a lot of panel discussions, and you know, there was this thing between the nonviolent kind of Gandhian type protesters and the people that were the Black Bloc. And I'll tell you, everybody that was under 30, they were really excited about what the Black Bloc was doing. And they said, well, we could have just set it down peaceful, but I'll tell you, America, they love violence. They, you know, football games. I mean, it's just like, I think in some ways it would have been kind of a snooze fest if it wasn't that stuff. Maybe they would have been able to shut it down, but I don't know.
I don't think that we would have been successful in shutting it down, because the police were going to use whatever means necessary to remove us. And that was, and they showed that right there. Their giant canisters of pepper spray, they were just spraying people within a foot of their face, in their eyes, taking off their gas masks and spraying them with pepper spray, shooting people with rubber bullets. You know, I saw people with major, like, wounds and bruises, you know, during the protest. They would come, look what they did to us, you know, and that was, you know. So I think the police, if they would have continued using their violent tactics, the WTO would have probably proceeded that day, but the Black Bloc basically was defending us, keeping us from being brutalized by the police, because the police did not have enough people, enough officers to take care of the Black Bloc breaking windows at the same time to brutalize us by trying to remove us from blocking those streets.
All right, so what about the Teamsters? How did they get involved? What did they do? The labor, and this was one of the first times I saw labor and environmentalists working together, because, again, they're both against state-sponsored corporatism. They see that it's corporations.
Yeah, that's they call it that, the Teamsters and the Turtles. And what they're trying to do is they have these fishing nets, and they had a thing where they could free turtles, sea turtles, from the nets. And they do that. They said that was a violation of the WTO rules. And so, but then it was, but the same thing were happening with Teamsters, like you couldn't have labor laws. So it was actually one of the first times that they got together. I don't know if it's going to, if it lasted or not, but I think it did bring a general awareness, you know, that we aren't just really that far apart, labor and the environmentalists.
Right. And so they, but they, the Teamsters tried to stop their people from going downtown. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I heard afterwards through various sources, that the main leaders of the march, because it was a permitted kind of like labor march, you know, part of that permit was like, oh, you're going to stay on this route and you're not going to go, you know, break off or anything. But a lot of the Teamster union members heard about what the police were doing to the the protesters and the road or the, you know, the blockaders, and they're like, hell no, we're going to go downtown and put our bodies in the line with all these other people who are being brutalized by the police. So I don't know how many numbers as far as, but I think it was several hundred union people came downtown, maybe more, maybe a thousand or two, and then basically doubled our numbers to block the ministerial from happening. And I think at that point, that was probably about 12 o'clock, 11, 12 o'clock, somewhere around there. And I think that was the beginning of when they realized that this ministerial meeting wasn't going to happen.
You mean the powers of Seattle, the Seattle
like,
government?
Like the mayor and the governor probably realized, we got the union people down there now, and, you know, not just these warm and fuzzy little protester tree huggers. Now we got some like big burly men down there that we got to deal with, and we're not going to probably want to try to push them around much.
Well, so this was successful then, and but now they meet, and I guess this is a success, but now these places, these people that meet to decide the fate of the world, they meet in secret now because of the battle in Seattle.
Yeah, in countries that aren't, were, you know, don't allow protesting, basically. And they also have this thing called the free speech zone, and it's like right. Nowhere near where the action is. They just, okay, you can do your little thing over here. And, you know, people can see through that.
Well, because Cancun happened in 2002, 2 years later, and a guy tried to sneak a banana tree into the, and they broke the gate down to the meeting area. So now these meetings just don't happen. Which brings me to my question is, now what do we do? Do peaceful demonstrations work? And let me qualify this question. I mean, even Gandhi, when he went down to make salt at the sea, you ended up, they were nonviolent, but violence was perpetrated upon them. Can we have peaceful demonstrations? And it seems to me that now that corporations have gotten wise to this, and they just use the police to have these demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations that, oh, look, a bunch of people marched, you might get some news coverage, and then the issue just goes on, is my impression. Is that, do you think these demonstrations work? I mean,
well, I don't know at this point in time. I think we slowed things down, but that's really all that, you know, in some ways has happened is... David Brower, I saw him at the Green Party convention. It was in 2000, and he said basically what we've done is we've slowed down the rate of, but that's unfortunately we haven't really turned it around, you know.
Well, because then we had the George Floyd riots, and those were turned violent, and they were across the world. It took a worldwide demonstration with a little bit of violence just to get a policeman convicted.
Yeah, but there's still, I mean, God, if I was black, I would never call the police to come deal with anything because somebody ends up dead, you know?
Well, you were saying, so, and police violence has increased since George Floyd.
Well, this last year, they had more people die. And it's like 40% of the people that that are killed by police are have some sort of issue with their mental health. And so... I don't know.
Well, and so here in the Palestinian, the pro-Palestinian demonstrations here now, there was one, I think it was right after October 7th. There's a guy walking around with a rifle in the demonstration. One other point I want to make is back then, email had just happened back then in the 90s when we did. And so a lot of our communications were done by email to get to organize the WTO. So when you're going to a demonstration, do you need to look at see who is organizing the demonstration?
Well, sure, yeah. You show up to something and, you know, if you don't feel comfortable in that position or what's going on, then you have a right to step away from that, obviously. But I think you need to look at history, you know, even Seattle, okay? You know, it's like we weren't sure that we're going to be able to shut it down. And some, in my opinion, without the Black Bloc defending us or dividing the police forces, we would have been unsuccessful. We can learn lessons from that. As well as, you know, we had solidarity with the union, you know, the Teamsters. And that was, you know, that was a hard relationship to form and keep going. But I think we need to do that again, you know, join up with labor. It's like, you know, we're working for the same thing. You know, we want a livable planet for ourselves and for our kids or grandkids or whatever future generations, as well as all life on the planet to survive. But I think we need to look at those lessons from the past, and actually implement them, you know, learning from that history and implement them in future actions. I think like tree sitting and occupying logging roads or logging operations can be successful, and it has probably saved millions of acres here in the Pacific Northwest. But on the other side of that, there was a group of people who, you know, took it beyond breaking windows. You know, there was a few ranger stations. At least one ranger station was burned down. Timber company headquarters were burned down.
Animal testing facilities.
Slaughterhouses were burned down. And so, you know, that had an effect too. And... I think that combined with the anti-WTO and anti-corporate fascist led to some better policy from the Clinton administration and even the Bush administration, the subsequent Bush administration kind of capitulated, and we actually ended old growth tree clear cutting in the Northwest, west of the Cascades, under George Bush in 2004 and 2005. And that was from tree sitting and blocking roads and other tactics that I mentioned, more extreme.
But mainly direct action, nonviolent direct action, but you're saying, and some vandalism, some large-scale vandalism also.
Right, sabotage, economic sabotage, vandalism. But yeah, that all contributed to putting pressure on these governments and agencies. Of course, you know, I don't know in the future what that will lead to with overt fascists that we might be encountering in the next decades.
And I just want to point out, we're not telling you to go out and do this stuff. We're just saying this is what seems to have worked and what doesn't work.
You know, people have done things. I mean, locally, they wanted to privatize Kesey Square. I'm part of the, I live in the Downtown Neighborhood Alliance, and I went to the first meeting when they were talking about that. As I'm saying, hell no, we're not going to have that. But people rose up and said, you're not going to privatize Kesey Square. That belongs to all of us. And I was in Salt Lake, and they wanted to do away with the oversight committee for the utilities. And people rose up, and they backed down, you know. So you can have an effect. I don't want to discourage anybody from that. You just have to have people power and, you know, shame the people that want to do this stuff or make it cost them money, you know, to move forward. And that sometimes will be when they'll pay attention.
Well, and so that's what came out at the Wandering Goat meeting, though, is the best thing to do is get with your neighbors. There's the most important thing you can do is talk to your neighbors and talk to a wide variety of people.
Well, yeah. I'd like to say that, you know, nonviolent direct action is the only thing that's ever changed the world. And as long as you're it's like you don't want to hurt any human beings or any life form if you're going to be doing direct action. You know, that's, you know, those don't go together. It's an oxymoron.
Right. You know? That's war. Well, you know, when I say that
that's what they use. They use violence. They will kill, maim, whatever they have to do to achieve their ends. We're the opposite.
Well, because I've said that, though. I've had anarchists tell me that Nelson Mandela used violence originally. And that was successful for South Africa. But I think that what brought down South Africa was the boycott. So voting with your dollars is another important thing we can do.
Yeah, you know, and with Israel, they've tried to do this, the BLM, is it BLM? The boycott sanctions.
BDS, yeah, boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
And, you know, there's been states in the United States that preemptively said that you couldn't do this. So they're having lawsuits about that, you know, and it's because they know it's an effective tool.
Right. And, well, so that brings me to also the media, though, was a critical part of, that was where the Independent Media Center started up that I got involved with, was where I had first heard of the Independent Media Centers in Seattle. And, where I had heard about this was the conference to end corporate dominance is what happened right before the battle in Seattle. So there was a teach-in about these issues. It's very important to do that.
Well, it's so hard now because the media is, at least the corporate media, well, I just call it corporate media now because that's the way it is. We don't really have any voices. So yeah, obviously we've got to use whatever tools we can, but I still believe that people being on the streets, exposing the wrongs of whether it's what your city is doing or your county or your state government or your federal government or corporations, you got to be on the streets. And it's just like, we've kind of lost that. We're kind of like, oh, we're just gonna post stuff on like social media and not actually physically talk to people face to face. You know, like during like 20 years I've organized around Eugene. I mean, one of the most effective things I've been doing is I'd go out and table, you know, for like a couple times a week. I'd spend 4 or 5 hours tabling at Sundance or the library, and try to get people engaged on the issue, whether it was the WTO or whether it was defending the ancient forest here or tree sits or whatever it is. But that face-to-face interaction, as well as like being out there publicly, like, oh, with the banner or whatever it is, saying, this is happening now, and if you have enough people out there with you, that creates that urgency in the community. It's like, wow, this must be an urgent issue because these people are really like, you know, not letting this go. And then they see it in the newspaper or whatever. And then, you know, but keep that, that kind of energy too is vital for any resistance to grow.
Well, I can tell you too, whenever I'm lost or can't find anybody to organize with, there's always, in every city, major city, there is always an anti-war demonstration. And we have one here every Wednesday, 7th and Pearl, that has been going on for literally 30, 50 years. There's been an anti-war demonstration. You know, this Idris Robinson is wrote this book on the George Floyd riots, and he's saying that the only way we're going to do this, the only way we're going to stop these people is violent revolution. And going back to the Teamsters, when they had that permit to march in Seattle, what would have happened if just the Teamsters had peacefully marched? What do you think would have happened? You know, it isn't going to work. And so, what do you tell someone that wants to bring their kid to a demonstration? I mean, that's really just a parade. What the Teamsters would have done up there was have a parade, and nothing really would have happened. Am I right?
I think you're right. I think, you know, I hate to say it, but I actually think sometimes the vandalism was because that's all they, a lot of them care about is the bottom line. If you're costing people money, then, you know, it raises people's awareness.
Well, I have this saying, I'm the only one that's saying this, but to me, poverty is violence. So there's nothing, I don't see vandalism is, if poverty is not violence, I mean, the word violence is something perpetrated on someone against their will. So poverty is perpetrated on you against your will. So violence, vandalism, and vandalism really isn't perpetrated on an individual against their will as much as poverty is.
Well, when you destroy clear cut a forest, I mean, I can't think of anything that's more violent, you know. And so I never use the word violence when I'm really speaking about vandalism.
Right, and that brings up the rights of nature, too. These animals and creatures have rights that no one is defending.
Right. I mean, economic sabotage, that's how I refer to it. It's, you know, it's, you're stopping the destruction. You're sending a message saying, no, this is not, we're going to make this unprofitable to you. We're not just going to lay down and let you destroy our home, our river, our planet, and just lay down and die. You know, we're gonna resist. We're gonna try to coerce you into stopping this destructive. I don't know what you call it. It's just it's driving our own species to extinction. I mean, if that's not the biggest failure of our society, all our institutions, as knowingly we're doing this, we're driving our own species into extinction along with all the other species that inhabit this earth. Some people have to step up and try to stop that from happening. And if it's the only way is through economic sabotage, then so be it.
Well, so what's going on with the forest, though, Shannon? Because you've been worked on forest issues for years, and Tim Lewis at the Wandering Goat event basically said they're just going to cut it all. That it's over, and that they're just going to cut it all. What is going on with what is the state of the forest issues, and is there anything we can do about it?
Well, you know, like I say, it's the heyday when they were clear-cutting old-growth forests, like tens of thousands of acres, we more or less stopped it, at least in the Pacific Northwest. Back in about 2005, we actually, you know, after 10 years of direct action, of tree sits, 365 days a year for 5 years and 6 years, and blocking roads, they actually did stop it on public lands. But now they're trying to go back. You know, they're like, oh, well, the resistance has kind of died, so we're going to go back to this, but we're going to call it something else. We're going to call it restoration or fire fuels reduction or whatever, you know, ecological forestry. You know, get that. They'll call clear cutting ecological forestry. And so, yeah, so they're reverting back. But I'm hoping people will jump back into things and realize how dire things are, especially now. when you know they're gonna try to take all the laws away, which we don't have many left anyway, but they're just gonna try to gut it all. So well, I mean, people have to step up.
I get a makes me happy that I see a lot of young people. I mean, look at all the people that are protesting against the Israel and their treatment of the Palestinians. And these people, you know, unlike in the protests against the Vietnam War, they don't really have a dog in the fight. Why are they doing this? You know, they don't. Their fellow citizens aren't, young people aren't getting drafted, sent over to war. And so it's just that kind of gives me hope when I see this much, you know, all these young people getting involved. I've been at this, you know, going on 35 years. And, but just to see people saying no is amazing.
All right, Shannon Wilson and Scott Fife, thanks for coming in on the anniversary of the WTO.
I'm hoping that soon there will be some organized resistance to the next regime coming in, the fascist regime coming in, and hopefully sooner than later, this community and other communities around the, at least the Pacific West, will organize some strong resistance.
For John Dillinger, in hope he is still alive. Thanksgiving Day, November 28th, 1986. Thanks for the wild turkey and passenger pigeons destined to be shit out through wholesome American guts. Thanks for a continent to despoil and poison. Thanks for Indians to provide a modicum of challenge and danger. Thanks for vast herds of bison to kill and skin, leaving the carcasses to rot. Thanks for bounties on wolves and coyotes. Thanks for the American dream to vulgarize and falsify until the bare lies shine through. Thanks for the KKK for killing lawmen feeding their notches. For decent church-going women with their mean, pinched, bitter, evil faces. Thanks for Kill a Queer for Christ stickers. Thanks for laboratory AIDS. Thanks for prohibition and the war against drugs. Thanks for a country where nobody is allowed to mind his own business. Thanks for a nation of finks. Yes, thanks for all the memories. All right, let's see your arms. You always were a headache, and you always were a bore. Thanks for the last and greatest betrayal of the last and greatest of human dreams.